This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball. Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is card number 786, Joe Price, pitcher for the San Francisco Giants.
All right, Joe Price. Before we get to Joe, we have some follow-up from last week's episode about Louisiana Lightning Ron Guidry.
I got a note from friend of the show, Ryan, who just said, "You cut out the drums?" And so I immediately searched Ron Guidry drums, and the first thing that came up was this article, Pinstripe Percussion, and Ron Guidry is quoted saying, "I kept a set of drums at Yankee Stadium for one reason. Playing the drums kept my wrists very strong, and a strong left wrist allowed me to throw my slider more effectively." So Ron Guidry was a skilled drummer, kept a drum kit in Yankee Stadium clubhouse, I guess, with the rules around facial hair. I'm surprised that George Steinbrenner allowed this kind of racket, especially from a guy who had no future in baseball. Maybe this was after he won a Cy Young. He had a little bit more leeway to run the clubhouse. But Guidry was a skilled enough drummer that he once played drums with the Beach Boys in a post-game concert. And if I know one thing about the Beach Boys, they would not let an unqualified musician into their band. Sorry, John Stamos.
Definitely not, but that's a great find. So thank you to listener Ryan. But your accusation of we cut out the drums, you're thinking of our other podcast, the 1988 Tops podcast Unplugged edition, which you can find in a separate feed. In this one, we always go hard, full drums, full amp. And if you have any corrections or comments you'd like to send into our mailbag, please email us at 1988topspodcast@gmail.com. So thank you, Ryan. Now let's get to today's card and Joe Price. And why are we talking about Joe today?
I was looking at the number of episodes per team, and the San Francisco Giants are way behind. We have only done four Giants. I think our third episode, and then one of them is like Ernie Riles, Big Daddy Rick Russell.
Yeah, Rick Russell was a huge one, though. So it like counts for five. So
yes, and that was in like 2021. So
but we are due.
Yeah, we owe the Bay Area, the other side of the Bay Area. I feel like we've done some Oakland A's, or the team formerly known as the Oakland A's. So now we're catching up on some Giants, and we will get to some more Giants soon. Joe Price has a Sabre bio by Bill Nowlin, and I looked at this card and thought, I remember this picture, because it's a real weird card, but I have no memory of this man. So I wanted to learn a little bit more about Joe Price and learn what's up with this weird, blurry card and why. I don't know if we'll come up with the answer to that, but Joe Price had a relatively long career, 11 years in the big leagues, and was a pretty good relief pitcher, used in both relief and as a starter, and had a solid career.
Well, sounds like all the makings for a good show. Let's go to the front of 786. And we've got Joe Price, and we have what looks to me to be, I don't know the style of art. It's not surrealist, because this is a realistic looking man. They've caught his face in an unfortunate place where it's kind of melty. And his jersey is very wrinkly. It's very odd kind of shot. It's very blurry in the background. It kind of looks like a blue screen. And Joe Price, who is in full delivery as a left-handed pitcher, he looks like John C. Reilly or some other kind of, you know, a character actor that you can't quite place. And the other thing that's very odd is that both his glove and his pitching arm look like they've inverted. So his glove is kind of pointing off and to the right, and his arm is rotated in, neither of which looks very natural in the whole pitching motion. So I'm very confused.
The background of this photo is very Mark Rothko, just the giant squares of a color. If we had some lily pads on there, it might be like a Monet. It's blurry, so it's not, like, if that was just a wall, it would be clear, but it almost, the colors almost blend into each other, the green and the blue. Yeah. It's very strange. I don't know why it looks like that, unless they were trying to cover something up. Is there a giant, like, Marlboro man behind him?
Maybe. No, it has a look of like, you know, Bob Ross kind of blending in, you know, blending together the sky and grass so that they kind of melt together. I really think there's a spot just above Joe's right shoulder that you could put a happy tree or two.
Mm-hmm. You could put a puffy little cloud.
You put a puffy little cloud. You could put a bit of a, you could put a crag of a mountain in there, and there's a little mountain goat that lives in there, and he's happy. Let's go to the back of 786, and we have Joe Price, 6'4", 210, left-handed thrower and right-handed batter, drafted by the Reds in the fourth round of 1977. Born November 29th, 1956 in Inglewood, California, with a home in Tampa, Florida.
This Joe Price is different from another Joe Price who played for the Giants in 1928. That earlier Joe Price had one big league at bat in his only appearance in the big leagues. This guy was born in 1956 in Inglewood, California. If I know one thing about Inglewood, California, Inglewood is always up to no good. That is in LA County, around 50,000 people when Joe was born, now over 100,000. Joe's parents were named Tom and Nola, and Joe described Tom's family move west as very much like the Grapes of Wrath. Joe's grandfather had heard that there was work out west, and so the family left Oklahoma and headed to California. Tom, Joe's father, was one of 16 kids. He was born in California and grew up in government tents near Bakersfield, California. Tom went into the bottled water business, and the family moved further south, closer to San Diego. Joe had three brothers and a sister. They lived about 20 miles northeast of San Diego in a town called Santee, California. I had heard something about Santee in a couple trips out to San Diego. I have some friends and family in San Diego. And every time I heard about this town, it was in a negative connotation. And I heard that the town was referred to as Klantee. And I was told that there was a KKK white nationalist presence in the town. But I didn't want to say that on the podcast without having something to back that up. So I did. I looked it up and found some stories, including a 2020 story of a man wearing a Klan hood into the grocery store and another wearing Nazi emblems also to the grocery store. I don't know, people just having exciting trips to the grocery store where they need to display their white nationalism. And I found a couple of different commentary items from the San Diego Union Tribune about Santee being a hotbed for white supremacists. And after those incidents, the town and some of the community members have attempted to get together, embrace diversity in the community. They had their first Pride March in 2021, and a lot of the sentiment around that was to push back against what many of the people in the town view as a vocal minority of people with white supremacist-leaning ideas. And so it does have that reputation. Joe attended Santana High School in Santee, and another negative about this area, aside from the alumni list on Wikipedia, the only other note about that school is about a school shooting in 2001, where a 15-year-old student told classmates that he planned to, quote, pull a Columbine. He ended up, shortly after that, killing two classmates and injuring 13 others. So apologies for that sad note, but this is an all too common occurrence in schools today that as we go through and look for the history of these schools, sometimes that comes up. On to the alumni of Santana High School, U.S. water polo player Alex Bowen, pitcher Hayden Penn, who played in MLB and won a Nippon Series with the Chibolote Marines in 2010, as well as 1974 American League save leader, 1981 World Series champ, and a guy who David Letterman called a, quote, fat tub of goo, Terry Forrester. Unfortunately, Terry Forrester is not in the 1988 top set because his would be a fun episode. At Santana, Price was a standout player. He had been recruited to play at some schools, so he was looking to go to college, including the University of Hawaii. But then he got a call on the night of the MLB draft from a scout named Harry Smith, who was scouting for the Orioles. Smith asked Joe if he wanted to get drafted or was thinking about college. And Price said, of course he wanted to go pro. The scout tells him, you likely won't get picked in the first 10 rounds, so you probably won't get a big signing bonus. But if you want to try to go to college, Oklahoma State would be interested. Joe hears this. He agrees to try the college route. And within a couple days, Oklahoma State offered him a full ride without ever watching him play. They trusted this scout and this scout's assessment. And so Joe heads off to Stillwater.
Joe, as a freshman, went 2-3 with a 4.17 ERA. It was okay. As a sophomore, he was better, 4-7 with 9 complete games and a 3.4 ERA. Joe liked Oklahoma State, but the baseball team really wasn't that good. When he went home after his sophomore season, he wrote letters to the University of Hawaii and some other schools that he had played against that he thought had good programs, thinking that maybe he would transfer. And that included the University of Oklahoma, the rival of his current school. The University of Oklahoma coach told him that he would love to have Joe on the team, but couldn't offer him a full ride scholarship, and Joe would have to sit out a year due to transfer rules. But Joe decided to go for it, which is kind of a strange decision at the time for students to transfer and have to sit out a year. But Joe goes for it. At Oklahoma, he only pitched in intra-squad games as a junior, but there were scouts that were watching. So after a junior year, having never pitched at Oklahoma officially, the Reds picked Joe in the fourth round. So actually it worked out. Also picked earlier that round, in a row, Jim Gott, Brian Harper, and Ozzie Smith. Joe had gone to an invitation-only tryout for the Reds, threw 2 innings and struck out 4. And from then on, the Reds were in contact with him, and they were ready to snap him up. Meanwhile, Harry Smith, the scout who helped him get into college, didn't convince the Orioles to draft him. But Joe is now officially a Red. He was sent to Billings, Montana for the Pioneer League for rookie ball. He went 6-5 with a 3.73 ERA for a team that finished 23-46, but he struck out 97 batters in 94 innings that first year. And that takes us to a fun fact on the card, that Joe was named Billings MVP Pioneer League in 1978. But David, I just read the stats for 1977, so I think that there's an error.
Again, another valuable error card. I think Joe was the MVP in 1977 because he was playing at A-ball in 1978 and did not play for Billings in 1978. 1977 was the only year that he played for Billings. It's possible that he was the team MVP because that team was pretty bad and he was actually good. So there weren't a lot of other options. They were outscored pretty handily when I was looking at the stats and pretty bad. But this fun fact has also led to a Wikipedia error because the Wikipedia article is citing maybe this card, but it says the 1987 Topps card. I don't know if some Wikipedia artists want to get in there and edit that. I don't have the time.
I tried checking this via Google when researching the card. And not only is this error in there and replicated, but Google also thinks that this card is worth $2. At least it's robot AI chatbot is, and maybe it thinks that the error on the back of this card has inflated its value somewhat, but I can't figure it out.
The Wikipedia entry says in 1978, Price was named the Pioneer League's MVP, and then it cites to a 1987 Topps baseball card, number 786. So they have the wrong year in the references.
Yeah.
And they don't even cite it properly because it says that he was named the team's MVP, not the Pioneer League's MVP. So going back to your AI results on Google, when I search for 1977 Pioneer League MVP, what shows up as an AI overviews are experimental, and it says George Foster was the 1977 Pioneer League Rookie League Male MVP. AI is getting worse.
This is why, David, having a membership to Sabre and getting Sabre bios is so important, because it's real research from real people, no computers involved.
I mean, I've met Mark Simon, so I know that he's a real person. We've said a lot of names on here that very well could be robots.
1978 in A-ball, Joe was dominant in Tampa, made the league all-star team with a 10-4 record and a 1.47 ERA. That earned him a call-up to Nashville, AA, for 10 innings, striking out 10. He spent all of 1979 at Nashville, going 6-6 with a 3.96 ERA, and had some injuries that year that led to that higher ERA. In the winter of 1979, he played in Puerto Rico for Caguas, And he said that was the first time he faced big league hitters, and he pitched pretty well. That gave him back his confidence after a difficult double-A season. In 1980, he starts at AAA in Indianapolis. He was 4-4 with a 3.87 ERA and a 1.19 whip. By June, he got called up to the Reds, who were dealing with his injuries, and finally makes his debut.
That debut came on June 14th. Joe got a start against the Cardinals, and he also earns his place in Grandma's scorebook. And Minnie Lee had this to say in her notes: Joe Price just came from Indianapolis, so we'll pitch tonight. Good luck, with multiple exclamation points. And Joe, in that game, pitched really well. He only gave up 2 runs in 6 innings, left the game up 3-2. Unfortunately, Mario Soto gave up 2 runs, and the Reds lost. I was looking for his first win in Grandma's scorebook, because I might have printed it out and put it on my wall, because his first win came on a big day, an important day for me personally, the date of my birth, June 28th, 1980. Joe gave up 5 runs against Houston, but still earned the win in an 8-5 Reds victory. That one is not on the Grandma's scorebook website, but maybe it's back in the archives.
I'm sure she marked the day in a special way, David. So in 1980, Joe had some very good performances. Overall, he had 13 starts and 11 bullpen appearances. As a starter, he was 5-3 with a 3.49 ERA, 1.26 whip in 80 innings. Out of the bullpen in 30 innings, his whip was under 1. And so overall, he had a 7-3 record with a 1.02 ERA plus. So very decent for his first year in the big leagues. And after showing that versatility, in the strike-shortened 1981, the Reds really valued Joe's arm because he was the only lefty on the staff. He was used out of the bullpen the whole year, appearing in 41 games and 53 innings. It's kind of strange, right? I mean, to have 0 left-handers in your starting rotation, but it worked for Joe and it worked for the Reds. Joe went 6-1 with a 2.52 ERA, which is a 1.43 ERA plus. And the Reds had the best record in the NL West, but they missed the playoffs because they finished second in the first half and the second half of the season.
After the disappointment of missing the playoffs because of the weird way that the rules were written after the strike, 1982 was disappointing for a different reason. The Reds were awful. They lost 101 games. They fired their manager, John McNamara, mid-season. They brought in Russ Nixon. But Joe wasn't to blame for that terrible record. He had the best relief season of his career and was the most valuable reliever for the Reds. He pitched in a career-high 59 games, striking out 71 in 72 innings, and had a 2.85 ERA. He followed that solid season up by getting forced into the starting rotation for all of 1983. The Reds had some injuries, and they would end up finishing in last place in the National League West again. They didn't lose 100 games this time, but won 74. So getting better, but still in last place. Joe started strong with a 2-hit complete game in his first start against the Cubs. He dealt with injuries during the season, missing part of May with an elbow injury. Then in July, he went 5-1 with a 1.98 ERA. That included a 3-hit win over the Mets, and he was named National League Pitcher of the Month for the month of July.
After that excellent July, he appeared in only 1 game in August and 1 in September. I'm guessing because of some injuries, but on the year, he had 5 complete games and more innings in 1983 than in 1981 and 82 combined. On the year, in 21 starts, he went 10-6 with a 2.88 ERA, was the second most valuable pitcher on the team in terms of WAR after Mario Soto. And due to that success, Joe was kept in the rotation in 1984. He had career highs with 30 starts, 171 innings, and 129 strikeouts. But his season was inconsistent as far as giving up hits. Through May, he was 2-3 with an ERA over 6. He also had some respiratory problems that caused that slow start. The second half of the season was better, though. From June through the end of the season, he had a respectable 3.53 ERA, but a 5-10 record. One highlight of the year was a 2-hit shutout against the Dodgers in July, which was his only career shutout. He finished 1984 with a 7-13 record and a 4.19 ERA. In 1985, he was selected by his teammates as the player union representative for the Reds, showing that he was a respected member of the clubhouse. And on the field, he split time between the bullpen and rotation, starting 8 games, went 2-2 with an ERA over 4, and in relief he made 18 appearances and had a 2.95 ERA. We're in the Pete Rose era here. The Reds won 89 games, and Joe had surgery in September to remove calcium deposits from his elbow, and in the process of that surgery, there was a tendon tear discovered, so he was shut down for the rest of 1985.
He ends up coming back from injury in 1986, but may have come back too soon. He only appeared in 25 games, and he ramped up too quickly. Through June, he was 1-1 with an ERA near 5. He shut down for a few weeks, comes back, and in his next start gives up 7 in 2 2/3 innings. And then he didn't come back until September, pitches a couple of games out of the bullpen, but really it was a difficult season for Joe Price. Pete Rose had asked him to be a Swiss Army knife, start some games, short relief, long relief. But Joe talked to the team doctor who said, you can trick your body into being a starter or a reliever. You can't trick it into being both. So Joe would go from one max effort, one out performance into a long relief performance the next day, and then have to be ready to pitch 5+ innings in a start. And in that, he'd have to throttle his velocity, plan differently. Just a really difficult role to be in, that swingman / short relief role. And that season, on a disappointing note, would be the end of Joe's Reds contract. So following a down year, he becomes a free agent.
So 1987, Joe is a free agent. In February, he signs with the Giants. And in spring training, he didn't really pitch his best. He felt like he had a dead arm. And so he was assigned to AAA Phoenix. Things turned around pretty quickly. In 17 games at Phoenix, he was 6-0 with a 2.49 ERA and was called up in July. So maybe just a little rest out of the majors helped him out. When Joe joined the major league staff in July, the Giants were around 500 and in third place. Joe provided a valuable role as a lefty arm in the bullpen. He earned a win in his first appearance, pitching 2 scoreless innings against the Cubs. In 20 appearances overall, 35 innings of relief work, he struck out 42 and walked only 13, with opponents hitting only 155 against him. This led to the Giants going on a run. They won 90 games to win the National League West, 6 games ahead of Joe's previous team, the Reds. And Joe finally makes it into the playoffs. In the NLCS Game 5, he entered the 5th inning in relief of Big Daddy Rick Rushel. And with the Giants up 6-3 already, Joe was great. He allowed only 1 hit and no runs in 5 innings to earn the win. He had only pitched 4 innings 2 times that whole season for the Giants, so this was a huge performance for him. Whitey Herzog, the manager for the opposing Cardinals, said, he looked like Rube Waddell today, and I'm not really sure what that means, David.
Rube Waddell was a old-timey baseball player who is in the Hall of Fame and was also an alcoholic and an eccentric crazy man.
We'll have to fit him in a later episode. Hopefully he'll come up again. Meanwhile, Joe said that the performance was kind of a dream. That win put the Giants up 3-2. They lost Game 6 1-0. So Joe's next appearance was in Game 7 in Busch Stadium. The series tied 3-3 and on the line.
The Giants go down 4-0 in the second inning. Joe's called in the third. He allows a hit, then gets 2 outs, gives up a single to bat-flipping Tom Lawless, and then he gets pulled. Kelly Downs finishes the inning, so no runs were allowed. Joe had overall a solid NLCS, didn't give up a run in 6 innings, but the Cardinals would win Game 7 6-0 to go on to the World Series, despite Joe and Hackman Jeffrey Leonard's best efforts.
This was the only playoff appearance of Price's career. Joe returned in 1988, but had shoulder issues requiring cortisone injections throughout the season. He went 1-6 with a 3.94 ERA in 38 games that year. He had frayed bursa in his shoulder that would require surgery in the offseason, and came back in 1989, pitching in 7 games in April, but had an ERA near 6. His velocity was down, and the Giants released him to make room on their roster. He signed a few days later with the Red Sox. Joe knew the Sox had been contenders, and he wanted a chance to win. But in his first 6 games for the Red Sox, he gave up 2 earned runs in 17 innings that were all losses. So very unfortunate. And in June, the Sox decided to put Joe in the rotation for a few games, and it just didn't go well. He made four starts, went 1-3, gave up four runs each in three of the games, and five runs in his last start that month. Joe just knew his arm wasn't 100%, and he wasn't equipped to start at this point.
He argued with manager Joe Morgan, and that earned him a short suspension for using some strong language. After Devon White stole second, third, and home against Price in one game,
ooh,
Joe got into it with his manager, sat out a few games, but at the end of the year, Price was 2-5 with a 4.35 ERA. He was let go in free agency, signed with Baltimore, and appeared in 50 games, all in relief. He had a 107 ERA plus. The Orioles were under 500. And in 1991, he was released, signed with the Padres AAA affiliate. He was very good, 2-1 with a 2.19 ERA in Las Vegas, but didn't earn a call-up. So he finishes the year back with Baltimore's AAA affiliate in Rochester. And after that season, he retired at 34.
So closing the book on Joe Price, 11 seasons in the major leagues, record of 45 wins and 49 losses with 13 saves, and a 3.65 ERA, which was a 103 ERA plus. In the loved to face, he loved to face Dale Murphy, who went 3-23 against him, Steve Sachs 5-29, and Ozzie Smith 5-30. Hated to face the kid, Gary Carter. Gary Carter went 10-20 against Joe Price with four home runs, three doubles, one triple, and 10 RBIs. Terry Kennedy went 13-26 with two home runs. And Willie McGee, 8-18 with two home runs, which was 2.5% of Willie McGee's career home runs were against the one pitcher. So hated to face him. How about in retirement?
When he retired, Joe went back to California. His dad at this point had owned a bottling company called Ramona Bottling in the LA area, and Joe helped his dad manage that. They ended up selling the company in 2000, and the parent company kept Joe on for a while. For a few years, he worked still in the bottled water business, and then he moved back to Cincinnati. In Cincinnati, he ran a mortgage company within a real estate business for a few years, and then the mortgage crisis hit in 2008, and he decided to switch sides and went to the real estate side. And we do have an ad from Coldwell Banker here.
Hello, my name is Joe Price. I'm with Coldwell Banker West Shell. I work primarily out of the Hyde Park office. I am licensed in Northern Kentucky as well as Ohio, so I can help you on both sides of the river. As a former professional baseball player, I understand completely what pressure is. And I can tell you that buying or selling a home should not be a pressure-filled situation. My job that I take very seriously is to keep that from happening. Give me a call. Let's discuss. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Joe went through a divorce. He got remarried and moved with his second wife and his parents and sister to Florida. As of 2021, he was married and living with his wife, Angel, on a 60-foot boat named Exodus near Sarasota. He and his wife also have a place in Florida, but they rent it out, and Joe and his sister Dory take care of their aging parents. Joe works on some remodeling projects, helps out at Red's Fantasy Camp, and generally says, "Life is good. I've never been happier than I am today." He still shows up at Red's functions, was featured in a video a couple years back talking about pitching fundamentals, and he raises money for the Angioma Alliance. This was something that I was unaware of until reading about it, but I found a video with Joe and Jim Leyritz joining up to throw out the first pitch at a Reds-Yankees game in supporting this Angioma Alliance. Angioma causes abnormal blood vessels in the brain and spinal cord, and that can cause hemorrhages and cause seizures and strokes. And Jim Leyritz and Joe Price specifically were in this to help some children who were suffering from angioma. They were doing some good work and raising some money for a good cause.
Indeed, a good cause. So we started this episode with a dreamlike card of a left-handed reliever in a vision, in a strange vision. But now, as it turned out, we've got a very straightforward career of just like guy with a left arm who just ends up in the majors for a long time. So now, after looking at it more, what do we think?
It's a common story. Guy has a left arm and plays 11 seasons in the majors. It was a straightforward career. It was a weird card. They really could have blue screened him into anything. He could have been flying through space on this card. He could have been fighting Rocky Balboa in this card. But instead, he's pitching in spring training at a stadium with a 30-foot-tall blue wall. And Joe was a lefty. He could start. He could pitch out of the bullpen. He pitched for both Oklahoma State and Oklahoma, both sides of a rivalry. That's strange. Nowadays, I think that Joe would have been used in a specific role that probably would have saved his arm. I don't know if it would have extended his career beyond 10 years, because he ended up having a long and productive career, but he threw hard and got a lot of strikeouts. Nowadays, he would probably just get called in to throw hard to three batters, call it a day, come back a couple days later. Instead, Joe was forced into this weird service between short outings, middle relief, starting. He'd have to regulate speeds, avoid injury, and he did so successfully. And it's really hard to judge his career stats knowing that he was just being plugged into whatever role the Reds needed him to plug into. That's a really valuable role and something that doesn't show up on the stat sheet, that you just have a lefty who can come out and do whatever. Joe had an interesting career, an interesting retirement too. This is the first guy that we've had who lives on a boat. I'm sure there's going to be more.
I hope so.
Pete Incaviglia has probably lived on a boat at some point.
Oh, for sure. And Corey Snyder probably.
Oh yeah, he lives on a boat.
Definitely has a boat. I like the story of him being, you know, willing to do anything for the team. His first three full seasons in the league, he's throwing under 3 ERA and would go out of the bullpen or start and just seemed to be a very valuable player. And I didn't really know anything about him, but yeah, it was a fun card and a good story. So thank you for that story today. And thank you to you at home. If you've got a 60-foot houseboat and you want to throw a party, you can invite us. Send us an invitation on Instagram. We're at 1988 Tops Podcast. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.